La 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 la. La la la. La la la.
If you want to hear your favorite technical news, give the Gizmo Gang a call. They talk megabytes to petabytes and cover it all. They're the Gizmo, Gizmo, Gizmo Sapiens. They're the Gizmo.
Hey, and welcome to Gizmo Sapiens Show 111. Happy Saturnalia to you, Matthew.
And you too.
Thank you. Because we know that I'm going to pull a Sheldon on you, and the reason that we celebrate Christmas on December 25th is actually because that was the high holiday for a couple of Roman religions, but mainly... what was it called? Glorious Sun was the would be the English translation of it. But they were sun worshippers. Also, why Sunday is spelled S-U-N day instead of S-O-N day, which would make more sense to me. And we also wish you a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year as well. This will be our final episode of Gizmo Sapiens for the year of 2016. Unfortunately, you'll have to put up with us again in year 2017. Before we jump into the more technical or tech stuff, I wanted to talk about yesterday, which was a historic day. And by the way, today is also a historic day. It's the last day of fall. Tomorrow is the equinox.
I don't know. It's freezing.
It's not nearly as cold as it could be.
Fair enough.
And after tomorrow, I will be a much happier man because the days will start getting longer. I don't care if it's 30 seconds a day for a month. I need longer. It helps me get up in the morning. But yesterday was a tense day for multiple reasons from a political news standpoint. One, it was the day the electors officially made Donald Trump the president of the United States. And what I thought was funny is they had to, with all the posturing and all this, you know, movie stars in California trying to get electors to vote opposite of what they were elected to vote for. The one elector who did get dismissed that I heard about was the
Christina Hagen.
The one in Minnesota. I didn't know. Oh. There was one in Minnesota, and I thought it was, I don't know who the guy's name was, but he was supposed to vote for Hillary Clinton, and he refused, and so he was replaced, dismissed, and replaced. I know there were a few others who
there were four Hillary, and then two Trump electors that did something else.
And I do know that, but yeah, you know that wasn't going to change a whole lot of.
No,
I mean he had. You would have had to have 30 or 40 electors do that, more than likely. But the other thing is, I know that four of them, all they pay is $1,000 fine for not voting. I'm like, really? And you know, even if they did switch their votes from the elector, that doesn't decide the presidential race at that point. It then goes to the Congress and they determine it, which is an interesting thing. But after yesterday, it's all of the niceties have gone away in the transition plan, I think. Because we have no hope. No, that's right. We have jubilation.
Well, when President Obama said that he was going to do what George W. Bush did and make for a smooth transition, I knew that, like everything else that man says, it had an expiration date.
What, 15 minutes later?
About that.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's been tense for the country, not because the election was tense, But I think there was a sigh of relief once the winter was done. But then it became tense again because a radical, and this is what I want to call it, a radical fringe element decided that they would try to upset the Constitution. And I find that really sad. You know, it does speak volumes to our culture today in regards to super small small groups with extremely small and very narrow outlook, both politically and socially, are trying to determine, you know, it's despotism.
But unfortunately, they have a very large megaphone.
Correct.
One that I think is disproportionate to their numbers.
Well, you know, I think that large megaphone is largely disproportionate to their numbers because it's disproportionate. And for the one reason why you saw a lot of blue-collar voters vote Republican this last time, when you typically don't. They usually vote, you know, pro-union, pro-social program, pro... And I'm not saying that all blue-collar workers that way. I mean, I come from a family of farmers, and they certainly aren't that way. And most farm families I know are not that way. But I think it shocked the Democratic Party that as a whole they voted typically against that. It's because it was an elite with lots of money and lots of media reach who were representing this fringe.
I mean, she spent billions of dollars for a job that pays $400K a year.
Yeah.
I mean, that's just downright stupid.
Well, you're right. I mean, because at the end of the day, it is not... I mean, the President of the United States is powerful. He's a powerful world leader. He's a powerful leader of our country. But on the flip side, our government is the government of checks and balances. So he's not the sole guy to, you know, create a despotism or create a
well, unless he has a phone and a pen.
Even then, there's some checks and balances. It's part of the reason we have the Second
Amendment.
We have the Second Amendment for that reason. But
I think the American people like that will. They've been saying on Facebook for a while now that our founding fathers would be founding by now.
Yeah, you're right. You're very right. So, well, enough political talk, because Matt and I've probably done I don't know how many episodes talking politically. But I do want to go on to some things that have been bothering me in the tech area. So Donglegate has been a huge thing, particularly now that Apple has shipped their new MacBook Pros. And my new boss, he needed it. He was running on like a 2006 MacBook Pro, and it was barely, I mean, crunching by, and it wasn't that old. It was like a 2009, but it was old for a computer, and. So he got one of the new MacBook Pros with the touchscreen, or touch bar. It's very nice. It's extremely fast. Even though the processors aren't extremely fast, the RAM and the SSD are so much faster than previous versions that it is markedly. I mean, you sit there and things happen instantaneous. But you know. I personally never buy the first generation of some of those technologies because Apple is a company who pushes the edge. They ever since Steve Jobs came back, and they went from selling beige boxes to selling boxes that were either Bondi blue or some other color or aluminum or rose gold or whatever. When they come out and they make a change, they will make a change. And some of them seem superfluous to most people. You know, other than it's annoying, and Donglegate is one of those that's annoying. So USB-C is the new technology. Everybody's going to be going to it. Google devices have been going to it. Apple has given you 2 years of the MacBook with USB-C only. And part of the reason both Google and Apple did that is because they were waiting for they knew that they had to put a device out there so that it would build demand for manufacturers to make peripherals that are USB-C enabled. And then, because it started out with one of the Nexus phones for Google, and then the MacBook for Apple, and then a Chromebook came out, the Chromebook Pixel came out with USB-C only. Then Apple brings out the MacBook Pro, and we're going to see, I think, across everybody's computer lines that's coming out. But Donglegate became an issue this year because you have a lot of professional users who use Power Macs to do creative work and other work, and they were like, well, now I have to get these dongles to plug all my old stuff in. Well, how is that any different from the transition from serial ports and parallel ports to USB? It isn't. People forget too easily. But there's so much good that comes out of USB-C. Like Apple teamed with LG for these 4K and 5K monitors that they have, and I want one of the 4K monitors because it has a USB-C hub in the back of it, and it comes with two cables like Apple's monitors. And that's part of the reason Apple decided to get out of the business, you know, making monitors is not our gig. That's somebody else's job because they're just sourcing the panels and everything from somebody else. But let's work with somebody who that's what they do.
Yeah.
And it has two cables. It has power cable, has USB-C cable. USB-C cable plugs into your MacBook or MacBook Pro. And one of the things that's cool about USB-C is DisplayPort is part of the specification for USB-C and USB 3.1. And so not only does it charge your Mac when you plug in that cable, it powers that external monitor. So you have one cable that you're plugging your computer into. Well, why would you need a docking station at that point? Because the monitor now has a hub in the back you can plug all your other crap into. Also, like on the MacBook Pros and so, and you're starting to see it on some of the upper end. Alienware has a couple laptops out that now have USB-C because Thunderbolt 3, which is a direct PCIe connection, is also uses the USB-C connector. And that's the only connector that Thunderbolt 3 connects to. So if you want to get the new super fast peripherals for doing like video capture and mass storage and things, you got to have Thunderbolt 3. So I just think it's annoying to me that people are complaining about it and making such a big deal. It's kind of like the presidential election. It's like fake news, you know, because it'd be like somebody said, you know, if we found a new refrigerant that to put in refrigerators that was like 10 times more efficient, but it required you to buy a new refrigerator, but yet it saved you tons and tons and tons of money per year because it's only going to cost you a tenth of what it would cost to run your current refrigerator. You know, yeah, there's a transition, and yeah, you got to bite the bullet and buy the new refrigerator, but and these dongles by far are not as expensive as a stupid refrigerator. Sorry, that's my personal peeve and everything. So let's see. I'm going through the show notes. I know Matt didn't have a lot to say about that because although he's a technology user, he's a Luddite in upgrading.
As evidenced by my archaic.
So here's one that this is a political one that I wrote down a while ago. So now that we have Brexit going on, as Donald Trump talks about bad trade deals, and I think he'll tackle that first because that's something that's it really is affecting our economy. And one of the things is that the United Kingdom could now become part of a new North American trade deal. Because they're part of Brexit, they're not allowed to be part of the European Union trade deal for a period of years. And that would be United States, Canada, and Mexico, and Great Britain. That could be pretty powerful because it could possibly change the onus of where Great Britain is getting a lot of its goods and services from other parts of Europe and China to the United States and Canada.
Well, I think amongst the many economic benefits for Britain, I mean, I think that's good for all four of those countries.
Right? Oh, yeah, absolutely.
I mean, there's impact across multiple economies there.
Well, so, you know, I think also it would
and across multiple industries too. I
correct.
Mean, it's
would be everything: consumer electronics, food, clothing. You know, all kinds of things. You know, and as we see this, and realistically, I do not believe that we're going to bring home what I call commodity jobs in manufacturing. I don't think we're going to see Levi's blue jeans being made back in the United States anytime soon. That just doesn't require the amount of skill that is necessary to do, you know, it's stitching stuff together. Those jobs, South America, I can see a big move to, because Brazil is now becoming the new China in many ways, which is great for Brazil. It's actually great for all of America, because you don't have to ship everything via the slow boat to China, as we always used to say. You know, back, we can now ship it. Some of it can be shipped over land, you know, more sensitive things. But I do think we're going to see an increase in, because I think there could be an increase in farming jobs. The United States is the breadbasket of the world. But if Great Britain starts getting most of their food exports from us, that's going to require more farm workers than we have currently today. Because a lot of American farms are automated, because we're producing what I call automated crops. There's not a lot of truck farmers around who are growing vegetables and fruits and things like that. They're, you know, when they do grow crops, they're growing corn and wheat and things that you can use very large scale machinery and pull down, you know, millions of acres of that kind of food and then process it. I think we'll see high tech jobs come back, you know, and I mean even high tech manufacturing. I do think that there is a big move in Silicon Valley, because they realize that there's issues with quality control and things manufacturing in China. Again, I don't think the commodity jobs, you know, if it's an $8 electronic widget, I don't think that's coming back to the United States. But I think you might see smartphone and tablet and even laptop manufacturing come back. We still have one of the largest fabs in the world owned by Intel in the United States, and they produce a ton of RAM and a ton of processor chips. You know, so I think that could possibly happen. The question is, will it be another disaster? You know, are these trade agreements really, you know, when they're broad like NAFTA, are they really good for anything? Or is it better to have an individual agreement with each country that you're trading with?
Well, I think that usually depends upon attitude towards what I will call fair and balanced trade. I mean, when one government or the other decides to engage in protectionism via tariff, that's never good.
Yeah.
And it always snowballs into something else.
Well, yeah, you put a tariff on it, I'm going to put a tariff on it.
And so these trade deals then become far more complicated.
They do. You know, and I think we're about to see tariffs come back on a larger scale again anyway, because, you know, economically, companies who are – and Apple always gets picked on because they do this. And, I mean, if you are the CEO or a board member for a publicly traded company, your responsibility is to the stockholders to make a profit. So if you can pay less taxes, which keeps your profit margin high, you're going to use every legal opportunity to do it. And, you know, if you're keeping billions of dollars of money, where the corporate tax rate is less. And I mean, company's been doing it for years. Commodore Computer, only reason they were headquartered in Bermuda is because the corporate tax rate was like 5%. You know, and technically, you know, and companies today have multiple headquarters across the world for that reason. I mean, you know, Apple holds a whole lot of money in Ireland because their corporate tax rate is a lot less than the United States. But guess who else does too? Dell and Microsoft. And you know, it's not like it's a single entity. Those guys are doing what their job is. So what does the government have to do to bring that home? Well, we're going to have to lower the corporate tax rate. I mean, you're stupid not to. 0% of, or 15% of nothing is zero. You know, or and it's actually closer to 35% when it's all said and done.
Well, and that same principle works even in country.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of companies are incorporated in Delaware for that very reason too.
So, exactly.
I mean, it goes beyond. It works in the micro. It works in the macro.
You're right. Absolutely. You know, so. I think these trade agreements will be important because they will use tariffs also as part of a sticking carrot to get that corporate money back to the United States.
And to be honest, I don't think there's any other... I'm going to call him a politician because that's what he is now. I don't think any other politician than Donald Trump would be able to pull that off.
No, I don't.
Or would even express interest.
Well, the thing is he. I think one of the unique characteristics that he brings, it was something that Ross Perot brought. And it's funny. So I was down in my dad's basement. We were getting Christmas ornaments out, and there was a Ross Perot for President bumper sticker down there, which I turned to my oldest daughter, who's 20, and I go, "That's really funny," and she goes, "Who's Ross Perot?" I thought it was really fun. Funny because Ross Perot said the same thing. What was that, back in the late 80s, early 90s?
Yeah.
You know, and if he had been elected president, he would have been able to do it because he was a businessman first. You know, he had to determine, you know, what was right for the stockholders and things like that, and these companies that they ran and essentially owned. And so they know what the sticking carrot is, and they know what their, you know, what the motivations behind doing what they're supposed to do is. Now, whether you could argue the whole Atlas Shrugs thing that happened and that caused, you know, you're doing what's best for the stockholder, not what's best for society type mentality, which existed before Ayn Rand published that book, but. Maybe that's a whole nother podcast for another day. So, the other thing that I thought, you've been predicting this for a while, Matt, that was pretty funny is McDonald's is now, there over the 2017, McDonald's is going to change their app. You know, if you have the McDonald's app today, you can see the menu. They give you coupons and special deals for using the app, but you still got to pay. And McDonald's is one of the great companies in the world, like Panera Bread, like Apple Store, like a local grocery chain, Dorothy Lane Market, does for us. They allow Apple Pay and Android Pay, which that's the way to go. But they're going to now let you order from your smartphone. And pay, because you can order and pay at the same time. And they've been doing this in other countries, like Australia and Thailand have been test countries. And but they want to take it worldwide to all the other markets. And part of this is to address the issue of, it has to be to address the issue of $15 minimum wage. $15 minimum wage. I mean... Other than being a manager and assistant manager at a McDonald's, and even I don't know that those positions were meant to be long-term life career, you know, positions. you know, McDonald's and fast food restaurants, the concept of that is they're starter jobs.
Well, exactly. I mean, you can look at McDonald's as one of those stepping stones to something bigger and better. It's never been meant to be a career. I mean, there's a career path.
Yeah.
But it's not, your average McDonald's employee is not going to follow a career path at McDonald's. I mean, it's, there are very few exceptions to that. But your average employee there is going to go there, work for a little bit of time, and then move on to something bigger and better that's in probably another whole industry.
Yeah.
And that's the way it's supposed to work.
Well, exactly. You know, that's also why the tax code for forever is kind of related to, you know, if you make $10,000 or less, you pay no taxes. Well, that's the idea, is that these kids, they're learning a skill, they're getting paid a lower but minimum wage to learn, essentially, it's training wheels to get into the workforce. You know, learn how to work with coworkers, learn how to deal with the public, learn how to work with a boss, you know, how to take direction and understand. But, you know, we're not trying to penalize these kids who are just earning extra money to pay for gas or to maybe to buy their first car or you know, pay for prom or whatever. But that's kind of the concept. It was never a concept of, okay, we're going to raise minimum wage to $15 an hour, which, by the way, now takes you above the, oh, wait, I got to pay federal, state, and local income tax on this. So it's not really $15 an hour. And then, you know, that eventually what's going to happen is somebody in unions are going to go, well, there's a revenue stream there, and let's unionize this. You know, because, and employees are going to, because the jobs pay $15 an hour, and I'm taking inflation completely off the table here too. They pay $15 an hour. Now they're going to feel like they need to be protected in their job. You know, you can't be just an at-will employee any longer, which, by the way, in the professional world, you are an at-will employee. And you know, so then they want to unionize. So, you know, I'm doing air quotes here, accidentally, you know, insulted a customer or something, you know, they couldn't let you go for that, you know. And I understand what unions were for, but I've also watched the abuses. I worked in the summer program at General Motors and had to pay union dues, yet was not covered because I didn't work more than 90 days. What? Okay, that's representation, or that's taxation without representation. I thought our founding fathers founded over that. And
I guarantee you paid more than 3% too.
Yeah. And, you know, I'm saw the abuses of the union. You know, we'll drop this grievance if you keep this employee who destroyed $100,000 worth of equipment intentionally so that he would get sent home. You know? And a guy who would go on short-term disability, and when he had to go back, he'd come back to work for a day and then go to the doctor after he was off work to complain and go back on short-term disability. I mean, that system is totally broken because it's never been regulated correctly. And I'm not a big fan of regulation, but anything that adds an extra tax has to be regulated. If you're expected to pay it to work in the workforce, which, again, totally don't get. I can't work for you unless I join the union. Well, wait a minute. You know, it's not like the union.
Theoretically, that's what the Department of Labor is supposed to do.
What's that?
Yeah, exactly.
They might not exist in another year or two, along with the EPA and somebody else. So this one, here's another one that's tech related, and I'm totally for this. Don't get me wrong. I do think that in the future, we're never going to be able, until battery technology can just be totally, totally upended, or we go fuel cell or something like that, I'm totally into electric cars. I honestly believe that for a majority of people, particularly in places like large cities where it, you know, distances to go places aren't very great, electric cars are probably the way to go, because it would create less. It create less pollution locally, although manufacturing might create more pollution. Lithium-ion batteries are pretty polluting. but U.S. Department of Transportation, I wonder if this will actually happen at this point. They have detailed plans to create a national network of electric charging stations on it says on some of the nation's busiest highways, which means if it says I in front of it, it's going to have a series of electric charging stations. Well, one, I have a couple questions about this. I know what it is. It's this cart before the horse thing. It's hard to have an electric car if there's no place to charge it when you go. I drive 200 miles and my battery's dead. How do I get 200 miles home? But the thing is the system, I don't know how it works, because if I'm building an electric charging, who's paying for it? Because today we pay a road tax on every gallon of gasoline we purchase. And that's actually what makes gasoline so expensive, because there's a federal road tax and there's a state road tax. And the state road tax can fluctuate from state to state. And that's why you go to one state, gasoline will be $2.059. You cross the border 35 miles away and it'll be $2.479. It's not because those gas stations are significantly buying gasoline, or they're realizing their margin position because there's a scarcity in their area is so much greater than 35 miles away. It is largely because the road taxes are, you know, from a state by state, and even road tax in some states can be also be local. So there's not only a federal and a state, but there can be a local road tax. But I actually think that's a pretty good system, because it pays for the maintenance and the creation of new roads.
Theoretically.
Yeah, there's some other issues. Also licensing vehicles, that also pays for part of that. Although...
Theoretically.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's all kinds of issues with that. So, like, interstate trucking, you know, semi-trucks. Big study done back in the 90s found out that a single semi-truck does 10,000 times the damage of a passenger car or truck, or even, you know, farm truck on the local roads and highways every year. Do we charge 10,000 times the licensing fees, and do they pay 10,000 times the road tax, you know, to cover that damage that they're creating? And that the answer to that is no.
And the reason for that is because those savings are passed on to you, the consumer.
Exactly. But I mean, nobody's okay, I'm going to build all these electric stations, and you see them everywhere. You see them, they're becoming more prolific, because we even have a Tesla dealership in Cincinnati down at Kenwood Town Center. And if you go into the parking garage near where the Pottery Barn and the Apple Store are, there's, four charging stations just for the Tesla dealership. And then there's four extra charging stations for, I guess, people who are bringing their car into, you know,
but
have
if you're,
the firmware upgraded.
But if you're the nice car, you're screwed.
Exactly. But you are finding charging stations in many more places. I forget where I was the other day, and there were two charging stations, and it was a shock, because it was like, really, there's charging? Why would there be here? And it was somewhere local, because I was with my kids. I just can't think of where it was. But how are we going to pay for this? Are we going to divert funds from the road tax to pay for this? Because that's not paying for roads, and we have a huge infrastructure problem in the United States now anyway.
I'm one of those people that I'm more of a consumption tax kind of guy.
Yeah.
So my take on that is that when you buy your fancy-dancy electric car,
you're paying for that charging. Or,
yeah.
Yeah.
That way I can keep my gas guzzler.
Well, I mean, I'm a farmer.
Well, yeah.
No, there's no electric pickup trucks. You know, so it's not like I can't. I'm going to be buying diesel for the remainder of my life.
Which brings me back to something you said about the study.
Yeah.
So that we're going to put these charging stations along highways, and you surmise it's going to be interstates, which
no,
concur.
This is not a study. This is actually a plan that the Department of Transportation has put together.
That's even worse.
Exactly. And they said a total of 55 interstates, including certain sections of I-95, I-80, I-10, and I-5 will be part of the National Charging Network,
okay,
which was mandated as part of the infrastructure spending bill passed by Congress in 2015.
So, electric cars are supposed to be short-trip vehicles by design.
Correct.
And we're putting them on interstates, as in travel between states plural. Which, to me, says that's a long-term traffic kind of place. So we're going to put the charging stations in the one place where the cars are not designed to be. That just sounds like government to me.
Yeah, well, you know, I largely think this is this is the government trying to influence the economy without thinking about how economics works.
So it's Tuesday in D.C., is what you're saying?
Yeah, so I'm going to build this charging network along interstate highways. Because if I do, I believe that will spur people to buy electric cars at their overpriced market values that they are today. Or we could not do this, save a ton of money, and the price of electric cars start to plummet where they become affordable, and people will start buying them for local travel, and then local communities can worry about and gas, you know, because that's the other thing. We pay, the road taxes are collected from gas station sales. Okay, how do you, you know, when you go, are we going to have electric charging stations that are like gas stations? You go up to the pump, you slide your credit card, you put in 20 kilowatts of power.
Yeah.
Or if you're Marty McFly, gigawatts. and charge your car up for 40 minutes at the pump as opposed to...
Wait, and then there's that. So you're going to go on this interstate trip. You're going to go... What's the current maximum distance?
I think...
200 to 400 miles or something like that?
Yeah, I think it's...
So you're going to go 401 miles and then have to stop and charge for 4, 6, 8 hours?
Yeah.
Then you're going to hop back in your vehicle, go the...
I know what the argument is, well, you know, it's people commuting to work, you know, that have to take the highway. So, think about this.
Interstate. So,
yeah.
You're going to go to work and stop and charge your car? No. You're going to charge your car while you're at work.
Exactly.
Not on the interstate. So, again, I ask, what is the point of putting them on the interstate?
Yeah. Well, also, what does that do to the industry? So, today, you know, and they have a very powerful lobby.
Sure.
But the oil industry, and I'm not talking the Arab oil industry, OPEC, I'm talking the U.S. oil industry, the guys who process and distribute gasoline and diesel fuel and kerosene and stuff. Are they going to now do electric? I don't think so, because the infrastructure for electric is built with companies like Duke Energy and you know, in Maryland, well, I forget what they're called, the Maryland Power, or whatever it is, that supplies Northern Virginia and most of Maryland. You know, so are they going to now build up this infrastructure and have, you know, charging stations with convenience stores? And again, because it takes a lot longer to charge. Even the most fast, you know, they talk about this fast charging battery technology that they're coming up with, which today shortens the life of the battery, which means, you know, got to replace the batteries.
That's by design.
Yeah. Well, it's also a technology issue. I mean, batteries will develop, as much as people want to say batteries don't develop memories, they're better at not developing memories, but unless you fully charge something and then fully deplete it and then fully charge it again, your battery is going to develop a memory over time. And then that brings me to the point. So is there going to be a used electric vehicle market? You know? Are you going to drive down the road, some high school kid is going to buy his first car, and it gets 15 minutes worth of drive time because the batteries are so bad? Or does he go buy a whole bunch of Duracells and pop them in?
I was going to say at best, but this could be at worst, depending upon your point of view. The vehicle that will survive the electric versus gas war is going to be a hybrid.
Oh, absolutely.
You're not going to see widespread.
Not until we get Mr. Fusions to put on it.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Yeah. That'll be electricity by other means.
Now, the other thing that you ought to see the show notes I actually prepared for this that Matt didn't read, but I have all these questions regarding all of these things. But I'm wondering if this is not by design to make people less mobile. In Europe, people are very less mobile than we are here.
That was the point I was just going to make. The electric car thing makes a hell of a lot more sense in Europe than it does in
here.
The United States.
Yeah. But when one state in the United States is the size of most of Europe, yeah.
Well, yeah, that's kind of the point I'm saying. It's not a... The scope and size of this country is
huge.
Far beyond the tiny brain of a politician in D.C. and or Europe.
Yeah.
I mean, it just is.
Yep. No, I agree with you. That's when I want to... I wish some listeners would give us a little feedback on, because I think that's a... it's something we see... We know it's coming. But, you know, what are people seeing? What are their thoughts about it? You know, maybe I'm too narrow-minded, or I have a... My view is so myopic that I'm missing a big point somewhere. It's always good to have another point of view. I mean... That's why Democrats and Republicans can be friends. Not good friends, but they can be friends.
True story.
I had a Democratic friend once. When he became a Republican, he became a much better friend. Didn't he, Matt? Okay, so let's move on to entertainment. And I know Matt and I have browbeat this a lot, but we're finally getting some more detail on Star Trek Discovery.
If you want to call this I'm not encouraged, by the way.
I know. Well, my favorite is the article, and this article came back out at the end of November, beginning of December, but CBS, they were talking with some of the producers and executive producers, and CBS Interactive Media CEO Jim Lanzoni he admits that Discovery wouldn't cut it on broadcast TV. And he says that, you know, their decision to keep Discovery on CBS All Access can be chalked up to how poorly sci-fi shows have historically fared on network television. Sci-fi is not something that is traditionally done really well on broadcast TV. The original Star Trek, extremely well. Firefly, phenomenal show. I don't think if you have a show and you keep it on one season, because you look at it culturally, and it has had a much greater... So I don't believe that... Now, yeah, do we have a lot of lame sci-fi shows? And did we? I mean, I can name 40 because they were campy. I mean, campy to the point of being stupid, not campy because they were entertaining. And even some of those are still entertaining to me. What was the one, the Space Rangers or whatever it was?
Yeah.
I mean, it lasted 6 episodes back
is
in
that?
Like 89, 90, maybe 91, something like
91,
that. I think. But I still enjoy that show. I actually found some old videotapes with
Nice.
But, you know, Earth 2.
Very well done.
Very well done show.
I thought the first season of Sequest was pretty phenomenal.
Yeah, the first season was excellent.
The second one was okay.
The third one went out the wall.
Third one went kind of... But this is the point where the networks jump in and they destroy stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, literally destroy it, trying to make it something that it should never have been.
But let's go through. So you have Original Trek, TNG, Deep Space Nine, Voyager, Enterprise. I mean, TNG, Deep Space Nine, and Voyager all ran for 7 seasons each.
Right.
And you know, frankly, those shows were... They kept getting better with in their first seasons, but I go back and try to watch the first season of TNG anymore, and I'm like...
It's painful.
It's painful. And so is Deep Space Nine. And it wasn't... And, like, my favorite seasons of Voyager are the ones that I think are really good, where the writing was excellent and the show gelled, are, like, 4, 5, 6, and 7.
Yeah.
And now, we argue about this. I love the first season of Enterprise because it harkened back to the way TOS was done. And that each episode was a story of its own. And you could watch them out of order, and it didn't really matter. Where they kind of screwed up, and I don't think they were bad because I still enjoy watching all them, was they took that Zindi War thing.
Unfortunately, that was woven into the pilot.
Yes.
And I don't think this would have been, had TNG never gone back to visit the Q character ever again.
Yeah.
It just, you couldn't do it.
Yeah.
And they couldn't get away from it.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, I still enjoyed that series, because I thought the first and third seasons were excellent.
Plus, they tried to Babylon 5 it.
Yeah, they did.
That...
Well, look how long Babylon 5 was on.
Well, yeah, but that's Babylon 5. You can't really do that with Star Trek.
No, I agree, but I'm just saying. The one thing that I'm tired of as a Star Trek theme, and Discovery seems to be premised on it, is the concept of time travel being an issue. But we do know that it's no longer number one who is going to be on the show. And it can't be the original timeline and be number one. It can't.
Well, you could always turn her into a Asian robot chick. I mean, that's...
Well, she's... Yeah. But she's not... you know, who they cast is not Asian either.
Are you missing my point?
I know.
I mean, you could turn Starbuck into a chick. You can do that. You can turn Boomer from a black dude into an Asian Cylon. You can do that.
But that's different because that wasn't them, you know, this being a continuation of a timeline that already exists.
Who said this was going to be the prime timeline? I don't think I've ever seen that actually said.
Brian Fuller has said it was.
But he's gone.
That's true. Now, if it's not the prime timeline, I'm fine with it. And it would make sense if it were the Kelvin timeline. Well, it can't be the Kelvin timeline either, because the Kelvin timeline, we know the point of where it changes. I mean, if it is, it's
you've already had points of discontinuity in the JJ verse already.
I prefer the Kelvin timeline. I don't want to mention JJ verse.
The Jar Jar verse.
Hold on, I'm trying to find my article in my notes.
But for me, I think it's hilarious. Hilarious that they've cast 3 Klingons for a series that's supposed to take place on a ship called Discovery.
I agree. Oh, here it is. Yeah, so the captain of the ship is Michelle Yeoh. And then...
The Asian Cylon.
Yes. And what's her face from Walking Dead, I can't think of her name, is the main character, Lieutenant Commander, and then they've cast two other Starfleet males.
You're going to call her number one. That's my prediction.
So
you can mark it down right here at the 50-minute mark.
Okay. I think they may have changed. They've decided to change.
I don't think so, because they're not that creative.
You may
it's
be
just
right.
Casting.
That's true.
It doesn't matter that she looks nothing like Majel Barrett. Nothing at all.
So,
it doesn't matter that... that the Asian Cylon chick looks nothing like the black guy that played Zora before.
You wonder why things aren't successful?
Precisely my point.
You create a universe.
And then you screw with it.
Yeah. No, I mean, I can actually get the whole Kelvin thing, you know. Hey, we changed time and all that. That makes perfect sense.
It does. So long as you diverge from a single point.
Yeah.
And then...
Yeah.
Then that makes sense. Yeah. But... if you're going to screw with it,
yep.
Then you have to believe that time functions in both directions, and that goes contrary to everything that we've experienced in the human experience.
Yeah. True. Who knows? Until we see the show,
it's fun to talk about.
It is fun to talk about. Well, because there's a lack of Trek and good sci-fi on, although. Have you been watching Incorporated on the Sci-Fi Channel?
I have not.
So I am not. I'm another genre of sci-fi I'm kind of sick of. I believe The Walking Dead, having read all the comic books, falls in this genre of sci-fi as well. And we have The Walking Dead, Fear the Walking Dead, and I watch them because they are entertaining. It's always fun to watch somebody get their head bashed in, you know. But is this dystopian view of the future. Because it was one of the nice things about Star Trek is that Star Trek didn't have a totally dystopian view. You know, it talked about how, not politically so much, but how socially humanity had changed and grown and become greater than it was. But Incorporated falls into this dystopian... But what it's funny about it is it's kind of a tongue-in-cheek, even though it's a very serious show, a tongue-in-cheek poke at climate change and all of this stuff, because it's predicated upon climate change has forced the government, the government couldn't deal with it, so it forced large-scale moving of people around to areas where they could live, so corporations... became really important because they were the ones doing the research to hybridize food to make it grow in these areas where it couldn't grow any longer, and then they became powerful because they then had the land rights to, you know, to farm, and they created their own private armies. And it's really now you work for a corporation, and we've seen this before, you work for a corporation, and that corporation is not only your employer, but they are your government. And the stratification and your status in society is based upon the level of stratification in your corporation. So, you know, if you're a VP, you live in a house with a swimming pool and grass in the lawn. If you're a lower level, you live in an apartment, you know. But it's extremely well done. And even though it's dystopian, you're looking at it through the eyes of a corporate exec who wears a suit to work every day, and it's blue skies outside and the grass in front of his home. And, you know, so it doesn't look dystopian, yet underneath it all is totally dystopian.
Very Max Headroom.
Very much. But probably more so Max Headroom in the sense that... at the highest stratus, it's like life hasn't changed. You know, like none of these disasters happened. Or in Max Headroom, they couldn't deny it. You know, it's just they hit it with other stuff. So, last topic, since my show notes go on and on and on and on, And I will not reuse any of these because by the time we come in January to do the next show, we will. There'll be a lots more new news. So
sure.
But I don't know if I'm concerned or not concerned about this because I find flying annoying no matter what I do, and I have to do it for work quite a bit. But the FAA may allow in-flight phone calls. Now, it's not like they've never done that. We used to have the phone headsets in the back of the, or the phones in the back of the headsets in the seat in front of you. And, you know, you could swipe a credit card and you could call. But the Department of Transportation and the FAA have put a proposal that would require airlines and ticket agents to disclose in advance whether voice calls are allowed on board during flights, which means that they're going to allow it in some form or another, whether it's a Wi-Fi call or what. You know, now, being that most travel is business travel, or most airline travel is business travel, I should say, I can see there being a reason to do it. I also can see there being a hefty charge, just like when you use the phones and the headset. But the other thing is if it's mostly business travel, I don't know that you're going to get a lot of people who will use it, except maybe only in emergencies and maybe only in first class, which is where it would be really annoying. But the reason is because, like, you know, if you're flying to Chicago or you're flying to Washington, D.C., you know, to do work or whatever, you're usually on a plane with your competitors as well because they're going to the same place. So you're not going to want to have all these conversations and stuff that, you know, while you're sitting right next to somebody who you don't know who they could work for. That's just something that happens. You know, I don't typically use my laptop on a plane because...
I could foresee this being the return of a flying phone booth. You know, like in 2001.
Oh, yeah.
Go all the way up to the space station. Instead of whipping out a cell phone, he goes to a phone booth. Well, I could kind of see that same thing on an airplane, couldn't you?
Yeah.
It'd be a little more secure.
It would only be on large planes, though.
Well, yeah. I mean, they're not going to give up seats for that. The airline would never put up with that.
Now, I say this, you know, I have a lot of colleagues who live on the East Coast who travel by train a lot. It's roughly the same amount cost. The trains all have free Wi-Fi. And they can sit at a table and work the entire time that they're traveling. You know, and frankly, even because of the time, you know, you have to get an airport at least an hour early, and you wait, and you can, you know, weather happens. The train is usually the same amount of time travel-wise as an airplane. And then you don't lose that productivity. Because like I said, I don't typically get my laptop out on a plane. One, it's uncomfortable. They've been removing the space between, particularly where you really see it now, and it's starting to bother people. Is they can't remove the legroom. People are bigger than they used to be, but the room between your face and the
seat
in front of you is greatly reduced than what it used to be. And, you know, how can you...
At some point, from an engineering standpoint, it became more important to fit more chairs in those airliners than it is about comfort of the passenger.
Well, yeah, because it's a cattle car.
Well, and that's
and it's all about how much. If I can put more passengers on, that means I can make more money because I can sell more tickets
per flight.
Per flight,
as opposed to
because I'm not
handling those passengers on the smaller planes that have a little more comfort and a little more.
Well, what's the option? Because ever since 9/11, airlines, you know, 9/11, I think. Just accelerated an issue that airlines were having, and that is they had way too many flights, and they were flying flights that weren't nearly full.
Sure.
And so they started
cutting. But they were doing it with those ridiculously large planes that they never needed in the first place.
And you know, so then they started cutting flights because fuel prices went up, and they couldn't afford to fly all those flights, but they never brought them back now that fuel prices have gone down.
The little puddle jumper airlines have been
They were all
filling that gap
they,
for the bulk of it.
Not really, because they don't exist anymore. So, like, you know, because all those little airlines got, the commuter airlines, or regional airlines, as they call them, were all purchased by other, you know, bigger airlines.
Sure.
So, like, Delta Northwest had Comair. They closed Comair. So, you know.
So they got no one to blame but themselves. I mean, you can't fill a gigantic airplane and go from Dayton
to D.C. is a regional flight. Cincinnati to D.C. is a regional flight. Back in the early 2000s, up until 2010, when they had C Terminal open in Cincinnati, there was a flight to D.C. on a regional jet every hour and every half hour during business hours all day long. It was great. And Delta actually, or Comair actually, did it pretty well. If you had a flight and there were only, it wasn't full enough to justify taking the flight, they would just cancel it and bump you to the next flight, which was a half hour later. So you weren't going to be late for, unless you had, you know, scheduled your meeting or whatever in D.C. so tight that half hour was going to make the difference between making or making your meeting or not making your meeting. You're going to make your meeting, because those planes were notoriously early anyway. They were direct flights. You know, yeah, you flew against a headwind going there, but coming back, those planes always had a tailwind. So I don't know. I don't know that it would bother me anyway, because I get in those seats and they're so constraining. It's like being in a straitjacket. So I just go to sleep, and I'm asleep before the. They go through the safety check, and then I wake up right before we land. I'm fine. So, well, we want to wish you guys a Merry Christmas and Happy New Year again. And we do want to hear from you, our listeners. We had some good topics today. I really think that we might have some constructive feedback. You know, comments on what we talked about would be great. You can send those to gizmosapiens@gmail.com, or you can go to our website at www.gizmosapiens.com and click the link to that episode and leave us a comment on that episode. And we'll see you on the digital flip side and in the new year.
Gizmo Sapiens, a technology and entertainment podcast. You can reach us at our email address at gizmosapiens@gmail.com. That's gizmosapiens@gmail.com. We'd really love to hear from you, and we'll see you next week from the digital flip side.